Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Susie Wyshek, the author of Good Food, Great Business, and your moderator for today's program. And now it is my extreme pleasure to introduce our talented and amazing panel of women business leaders, Jill Litwin, who founded Peace of Mind, Catherine Lucas, who founded Farmhouse Culture, Grace Erickson, who's the general manager of Ocho Candy, who makes organic candy bars, and Elizabeth Wu, the author of Raising Dough, an all-around financing for food expert. We will be having a conversation among these women about their businesses, their vision for the future when they started, and where they see themselves going from where they are today. And so without further ado, I'd like to welcome Jill Litwin and hear a bit about what led you to start Peace of Mind and what does the company do?
Thank you, Susie. So I am Jill, and I founded Peace of Mind about 10 years ago. I was living in Burlington, Vermont, and working in the snowboarding industry. And a colleague of mine was having problems feeding her little one. So I loved cooking, and she explained to me that she would literally go home and open a can of green beans for her son, and that's what she would feed him for dinner. Growing up, I would tell my mom I was allergic to green beans because I just despised them so much. So this really struck a chord in me, and I decided that I would start cooking age-appropriate, all-in-one meals for him. I wanted them to contain all the four food groups. And that became our first product line back in 2005. I really grew the business organically. I started out working out of La Cocina Community Kitchen, if you're familiar with them, and I was their first program participant and their first graduate. And then from there, I've gone on to grow the business into five product lines. We are in retailers nationwide, everywhere from Whole Foods to Super Target to Walmarts to Safeways. We're going to be shipping into school soon, and it's just been a huge journey for me. I always say that the business really found me, and I just was open to it. I definitely have that entrepreneurial computer chip inside me. You know, I've always been a self-starter, and when I worked for other people, I really didn't like being confined by my job title. I'm sure a lot of you can relate. I just wanted to run all the other parts of the business and just really immerse myself into business. And that's what I love most about owning Peace of Mind. I get to do things such as media planning or PR or finance or R&D all in one given day. So that's Peace of Mind.
So Catherine, your company is also focused on healthy food. Let's hear what led you to start and where you see yourself going.
Well, love started my business. I'm a California girl who fell in love with a German, and I moved to Stuttgart, Germany, and I had a restaurant there, and I learned how to cook there. And I tasted real sauerkraut from a barrel for the first time there, and this was in the mid-90s. And it was a revelation. I started using it in everything. Fast forward, came home in 98 without the German husband, and cooked for a while here in California, was a private chef, did a few things. And then when my son was getting ready to graduate high school, I knew I wanted to learn how to cook more natural foods, and I learned how to ferment kraut at a natural culinary program in Santa Cruz. And it was just an immediate sort of, it clicked. I just knew I'd found my next passion. I'm pretty focused culinarily. It turns out that kraut's healthy. That works out really well. It could have been chocolate, I got to be honest, you know. And, you know, for me, I think Farmhouse Culture has been sort of a reinvention and a recycling of all the different things that I've done in my life have kind of led me to Farmhouse Culture. And by that I mean my travels, my interest in traditional foods. I've studied all over the world and wrote a thesis on pre-corporate food traditions. And then my love of the culinary. And I was so fascinated by kimchi and then by the fact that California is almost halfway in between Seoul and Munich. and we have this bounty here. And I thought, why are we not doing foods that really represent this region? Why are we still, as Americans, eating cabbage and salt? Why aren't we putting lots of interesting ingredients in our krauts like the Koreans are? And then I looked around, and not that many people were doing it. And I'm thinking, and this stuff is good for you. And, this is an opportunity. I think I'm going to start focusing on this. And so I took a good 6 months to write my business plan and get advice, and started out very small at farmers markets and through a friend's CSA box, and then built it through natural food stores, and am now selling nationwide. And the company's essentially doubled every year. And a couple of weeks ago, we were ranked the number one raw kraut in the country.
Wow.
In terms of sales.
Congratulations. And when was that real turning point from when did you go nationwide?
We've been nationwide for about 3 years, but it's been pockets, mm-hmm. and we're still filling out all the pockets. It's kind of a progression. I would say by the end of 2015, we'll have a really, really good coverage. But I think Whole Foods was the company that helped us move into the nationwide scene.
I'm chomping at the bit to get to the financing, but Elizabeth will be a great panelist for that. And Grace, let's hear about Ocho Candy, who I love.
So, as Susie mentioned, I work for Ocho Candy as the GM. Unlike the other women on this panel, I did not found the company, but I have spent the majority of my career pursuing positions that allow me to learn more and more about how to run a food company. So early on in my career, I started out at Ghirardelli Chocolate. I worked in planning, accounting, and industrial engineering. And then from there, I moved on to a startup company called Cho Chocolate, which was based here in the city now since they've moved it to the East Bay. But I set up the infrastructure for their operations and safety programs as their production manager. And then after that, I consulted a little for myself for them and Ricuti Confections, which is a truffle manufacturer in the city. Worked a little in marketing for American Licorice Company. And then from there, I went to Ocho, where I help run the facility and bring their manufacturing in-house. So currently we're in West Oakland. We manufacture organic versions of traditional candy bars. So we have a healthy objective, but we are still very much into candy and the sugary sweetness that it is. So that's what I do and how I help out in food business.
And I know Ocho's really growing at this point.
Yes, we're growing crazy. So we're actually potentially moving soon. So that's going to be also very exciting for us. We're outgrowing our current capacity, so we need more space and production ability.
Moving
within West Oakland.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth, I'd love to hear about the type of work you do and what trends you're seeing in financing for businesses like this.
Sure. So the work that I do has evolved quite a bit over the course of my career, but my undying devotion has been for the last about 12 years to food entrepreneurs. And I think food is such an exciting topic for so many of us because it hits so many social issues, it hits health issues, whether we're talking about community health or our bodies, the health of our families, and the health of the economy. I mean, it's one of those issues that touches everything, and it touches all of us in a very visceral way on a daily basis. And when I was getting my MBA in sustainable management from Presidio Graduate School, and here we are raising up the next generation of food entrepreneurs to found these businesses that are so clearly based upon a deep set of values and a very deep mission. And yet the financing options for these businesses were the same as they were for any other type of business, which leads you down this track of get as big as you can, as fast as you can, and then sell to a large multinational corporation or go public, and then all the values go out the window. And I was thinking, well, it's not enough to just start new companies that are solving social and environmental problems. We also need to look at how can we connect these passionate, values-based entrepreneurs with money that matches those values. And so for a while I thought that the missing link was educating investors and philanthropists and institutional investors on the different ways that they could support socially responsible food businesses, because you know many of those folks say that they want to do it. The money wants to move. And then for a while, I thought the problem was that we needed better financing instruments. So in addition to just a traditional loan or traditional venture capital, can we create new loan funds or new investment funds that are better suited to the values of these, particularly the newer food entrepreneurs that are looking at community-scale businesses and not just businesses that want to take over the world? And recently, I've decided that one of the biggest barriers to entrepreneurs accessing capital is that a lot of entrepreneurs don't love talking about the money part and don't always love asking for money. And this isn't always true. I think most of the successful businesses you'll see, there's somebody on board that loves sharing the mission, loves sharing the values, and loves asking people to come on board. But the work I've been doing lately is around coaching entrepreneurs and getting comfortable with sharing their passion and asking for people to join them through asking for money.
So, Catherine, I know you're involved with Slow Money. Can you tell our audience about how they've helped you and how you engage with that movement?
When I read Woody Tash's book, Slow Money, it really changed my perspective on asking people for money. I was one of those entrepreneurs that was afraid to ask people for money. I was raised in an environment, I was raised in a family of entrepreneurs, and you don't ask family and friends for money. And Woody's book helped me understand that I could go to family and friends and give them an opportunity to invest in a company that was going to make the world a better place. And it just shifted the entire, my courage levels changed significantly. And there are slow money groups, investment groups popping up all over the country, and they're a great resource for entrepreneurs just starting out. And there's some interesting financing instruments that they've created along the way.
And have you tapped into those for your actual funding?
I have.
So how are you, if you want to share, how are you funding your growth?
Oh my gosh. That's an ongoing story.
It never ends.
It's a never-ending story. Angels, investment partners, and then a loan through Slow Money, which has been great. It's royalty-based financing. It's a little different, and so if we're doing well, we pay back more. If we're not doing quite as well, there's some forgiveness there, which is really, it's a lot less intimidating. And it's an ongoing issue, the raising the money, especially if you're a fast-growing company, as a lot of us know. If you're doing these double-digit growth, your company might be profitable, but it's definitely cash hungry.
And those of you who have read the book saw a lot of wisdom and experiences from Jill Litwin, and she shared about how to hire co-packers, the issues with financing and sourcing ingredients. Jill, would you share a bit about how you financed your business and what challenges you've run into with your production runs and growth?
I'm going to start present day and then go backwards, because I feel like part of financing and cash flow is also a big part of that, is how you set up your terms. And so for our products, we don't manufacture our products ourselves. We use 3 different co-packers in the country. And I have 3 different co-packing agreements with each of them, and those all needed to be negotiated. And then we sell to distributors mainly, and those also are agreements. And we do some direct sales, and so we're able to set up terms with everybody on how we want to be paid and when we want to pay. And I think that that's really, really important. Our major factory is based in the Midwest, and our arrangement with them is we pay when orders go out the door. So we do a huge production run so we can get, you know, efficiencies and economy of scale for pricing. But then they sit on the inventory, and I only pay when I sell the goods. And my terms with them are net 30, so I pay them 30 days after the goods leave. And usually I'm paid before net 30. So that really helps to set me up currently with cash flow. And that's a huge help. In the beginning of the business, though, when we're just getting started, all of us, you know, we have a lot of expenses that are startup costs and, you know, costs to get us going. And I funded the business with 2 convertible loans. That's how I started the business. And what that means is basically mine was friends and family, and I received two loans that could convert to stock at a later date if I choose to raise money later, or I would pay them back as a loan. And so I received those, and then I think maybe 2 years later, I raised angel financing. And so those loans converted to stock at that time. And I never had to pay any of that back. And so the angels that I found, it was really serendipitous, and I feel really fortunate. People had been watching what I was doing. Peace of Mind has always been and will always be kid-centric. We're focused on kids and getting them to eat their vegetables. That's what we do. And not just, you know, veggies. We want servings of veggies in everything we do. And that has been a topic that has started to trend around the time I started the business, and it hasn't stopped because I don't feel it's a trend. It's more a movement of combating childhood obesity and just, you know, our kids need to eat better today. So people have really been watching what I was doing, and I was approached by two different people and asked if I wanted money. And so I just got really lucky, and at the time, I wasn't really interested. I thought I could just do this on my own. And so then another year went by, and somebody said, like, I would really love to be involved in any way you want. And I said, you know, I'm actually starting my quest to look for financing. And it was really, everything that I've done in my business, I've done first. And I've taken one step at a time. And for me, that's proven to be the way that works for me. I want to have a relationship with people. I don't just want to exchange money or, like with our factories, this is a relationship. I mean, I courted our main factory for months before we ever started working with them. And I think that that is really important, the relationships that you form.
And when you say you courted them, is it that they had the exact set of criteria that would be just the perfect relationship for your distribution and your production?
I would say, so our needs, we need, you know, certain equipment, and they had that equipment. And courting is getting to know each other. I mean, I would have, maybe every other week I would have a call with the owner of the factory, and we would just talk business and what he does and what we do and what we want to do and what he does. He co-pack for other people, and we just kept getting to know each other and learning about the products, our products, and new product ideas that I had that he would hopefully be making for us one day. And we were in a situation where the factory we were using, I could just tell that we were going to be having problems down the line. So I really just wanted to start a relationship with somebody before we were desperate. That's a horrible time to move when you're desperate and you have to, you know, move on a dime. That'll never be good for you with your terms. So we just formed this really nice relationship, and we've been with him for years, and he is just the best. And I can't speak enough about how important the relationship is with all your partners.
That's wonderful. We talked, it seems like, years ago. I know. Yeah. And so it's great to hear where you are now. Well, one thing I write about in the book a lot is serendipity, and I met Grace at a cafe because she was wearing a T-shirt that said Ocho Candy, and I said, "Do you work there? What's your relationship?" Has anyone here had Ocho candy bars before?
Oh, good.
Yeah, nice. I just love them. I feel like they're among the finest confectionery I can find.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We think so, too. It's always nice to find validation elsewhere.
So I would love to hear kind of what Ocho has found. Are you nationwide now?
We are, excitingly so, yes.
And is the company going global, or are you waiting to see?
Right now we're waiting to see if there's a lot of white space nationwide that we can tap into. So the East Coast, actually the North Atlantic, has been very big for us most recently. We just got into the South region for Whole Foods, the Southwest. So that's been very exciting.
That is.
Yeah.
And do you foresee opening production closer to this, since chocolate melts? I know it's a whole different issue. We have frozen food here. Now, I forgot, is yours refrigerated or shelf-stable?
Refrigerated. Yeah.
And then meltables.
That's true.
Yeah.
Not for the foreseeable future. That would be much further down the road. Right now we use reefer trucks. Down the road, if we really needed to get more product on the East Coast, we could always use just increase our levels of inventory at distribution centers on the East Coast, but not manufacturing facilities at this current time.
And if you can share, how has Ocho Candy funded the business?
Yeah, so the two founders of Ocho Candy, one, Dennis Ring, he worked for Whole Foods. He actually sold the idea, the 365 label, to Whole Foods. So he was the brainchild of that. And he sold that off to them. And then the other founder is Scott Kutrick. He founded Zip Realty. So he made his money that way. So the company, the majority of the company is funded between those two gentlemen. And we also have one angel investor, as well as a loan from Wells Fargo.
Hmm. And Catherine, I'd love to hear you talk about your sourcing for cabbage as you've grown across the country. Is that something, are there new farms cropping up producing cabbage, or how are you going about the sourcing?
Well, that's a great question. We started out sourcing from local farmers that we met at farmers markets. And we would get all different types of varieties of cabbage. And I realized at a certain point that I needed to source one or two varieties so that my product could have a consistent taste and texture. And so it became harder to source from a lot of small farmers. And also, some farmers would say, yeah, I can get it to you, no problem. Well, you know, it's October now, I'll make sure you have plenty in March. And if they weren't very seasoned farmers and the weather didn't play along, all of a sudden I didn't have cabbage, and then I'm going out to the open market and I'm paying really high retail prices. So I started working with Lakeside Organics in Watsonville, and they are a large family-owned organic farm, and they were able to meet our needs, which have been pretty extensive. So we purchase most of our cabbage through them. They grow two varieties for us. And Mother Nature is still, presents her challenges. But California is the only state in the country where cabbage can grow year-round. And so it makes this area really prime area for this type of business. And then in April, we're moving out into the middle of an organic farm south of Watsonville. Our farmer actually bought the land. And with the intention of becoming my landlord. I was very excited. I found the property, and I begged everybody I know to buy it. And he finally said yes. And so we've got a large facility that we're in the process of renovating there. And I'm super excited because that means that 99% of the vegetables that we put into our krauts will now come, instead of within 20 miles of our facility, within probably 5. So that's been something super important to me, is to create foods that are really specific to a region that have this terroir. That's something that my experience in Europe, really, when I came back to the States, I came back with fresh eyes and came back to a homogenized food culture. And it was so boring, so boring. And I thought, gosh, I love this idea of regional foods. And so back in the late 90s, that was something I was really interested in. And it's wonderful to see that locals now are a regular word. But sourcing is super important to the values and I think the quality of our product.
It's exciting to me to see the variety of production methods too, just to understand all the possibilities of partnering or doing it yourself. Were you about to say something?
Well, and I really appreciate your sourcing and growing it yourself, and I was just thinking that would be totally impossible for me. Our plant is in South Dakota, and nothing grows there during the winter months.
Sunflower seeds?
Yes. Yeah,
no, not in the winter, though.
I don't even think the winter.
You'd need to have an ice company.
Yeah. Yes.
Elizabeth would know, I think. Do you know the Slow Money book? Isn't there a subtitle after the title Slow Money?
Oh, I don't actually know.
Investing as though
Fooms,
food, farms, and fertility matter.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I actually ran the Slow Money project before Woody wrote the book. So from 2005 to 2007, it's a really great organization that is really holding the conversation around what would it take to bring values-based financing to these food companies that are really creating the communities that we want to live in, so like more on a place-based level. But I'm also fascinated, like, none of you really talked about how you finance, I mean, other than the founders financing it in the beginning. I mean, there's so many challenges to early stage and startup food businesses. You can't go to a bank and get a loan. You're not going to get the attention of an angel investor if you don't have at least a few couple years maybe of revenue history. So I'm curious to hear more about what happened in the beginning.
Well, I can speak to that really briefly. We actually had a similar story to Jill, where the angel investor found us and said, I love your product, I want to invest in the company. And at that time, Ocho wasn't looking for funding. They took him on as a partner. It made sense. It still makes sense. And with regard to banks, absolutely, it's very hard to find loans early on unless you have independent wealth and capital of your own that you can work through. But once you do purchase equipment and have assets that you can take a loan out against, it becomes a little bit easier. So that's what we've done, and that's allowed us to manage our cash flow a little bit better.
But even getting to that point, I mean, part of why I wrote my book, Raising Dough, The Complete Guide to Financing a Socially Responsible Food Business, is because, I mean, now is a very exciting time to raise money for a food business. There are more people than ever before who are interested in moving their money off of Wall Street and onto Main Street and into their neighbors and friends' businesses. But it's really hard to evaluate whether or not all these different types of financing are a good fit if you can't find all these different methods in the first place. And so the book was my attempt to map out the very exciting and rapidly evolving landscape of financing options. So, I mean, did any of you use crowdfunding or Kickstarter at any point?
Well, actually, I'll just chime in briefly. Originally, Sosu Sauces, who makes sriracha sauce in the East Bay, was going to be here, and she couldn't be here. But she explained that Kickstarter has been instrumental to the funding her business. And they make their sauces with organic tomatoes when they're in season. They don't use tomato paste or anything processed. So she needs big chunks of money to do the production runs, and they have their own little production kitchen. So Kickstarter, they did two campaigns to fund their production, and she just couldn't say enough good things about that as how they got started and how they're able to grow. Just thought I'd chime in with that. So, Jill, I know you talk about it in the book quite a bit, actually, and how you find co-packers, but I'm also curious, as you go into schools, will your current co-packer be handling your food service production, or will anything change there?
No, I mean, they are the experts in, so we have a product line called Veggie Wedgies, and they're baked crispy french fries made from vegetables. We make a broccoli french fry, carrot french fry, cauliflower fry, and they're amazing. They're baked, so they are fat-free, allergen-free, and not organic. And they're the experts now in making our fries, so, I mean, I wouldn't want anybody else producing them but this factory, and they're, I think, maybe the fifth or sixth factory that we've worked with on our fries. And so we've been either outgrowing factories and needing to move, or there have been problems and we've needed to move. And so that was part of the courting process for me, is picking a factory that had the capacity to grow with us, along with their other business, and a place where we could, you know, stay and have a healthy relationship. So...
Interesting. Catherine, a couple of audience members have questions for you, which I will combine. As you were scaling into your commercial production, what regulatory issues did you run into, and how did you arrive at the innovative packaging that's allowing you to distribute nationwide? And
well, when I first applied for my health food license, the inspector said, we have really no idea how to regulate sauerkraut. So go out and find somebody who is an expert and help us help you. And they gave me a couple of leads, and I found out that there'd never been a case of food poisoning related to sauerkraut according to the USDA in the United States. It's a really safe food. It turns out that the lactic acid fermentation process is a kill step and considered safer than pasteurization. So that was good news. The inspectors have been nothing but
that helps.
Great. They won't let me ferment in wood, which is fine, but it has just been really easy. And because I had that good training in Germany, I keep a super clean operation, and they just kind of come in and say hi now because they know things are perfect. And all the things are a little crazy these days because we've exceeded our capacity. Yeah. And then the second part was...
About your packaging?
The packaging. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so I'm going to try and keep this brief. I went to the World Kimchi Conference in Washington, D.C. like 3 years ago.
And I'd love to go to that.
And I meet all these Germans there. And also the guys from the Pickle Packers Convention, and that I'd met, and they were all there, and they're like, "How can you sell your live kraut in a jar? This would never fly in Europe. You can't do that. Everybody knows that live kraut is going to carbon dioxide is going to build up. It's going to breach the seal, and if something can come out, then something can come in, and that's completely verboten in Germany." And I said, "Well, what do you guys use?" And I started this conversation, and I started looking at the Koreans and the Swiss and the French, and I found a bag in Switzerland, very similar to what I'm using now, with a little vent on the back that allows carbon dioxide to off-gas and prevents oxygen from coming in. And so I just kind of started there and then started designing, and it was a big risk. It was really scary. Right until the last minute, we were going, gosh, should we do this? Should we do this? Are we going to freak people out? We're going to be in plastic. We're in a good quality, food-safe plastic, but plastic is plastic. Like, there were all these concerns. But when we realized that our footprint was cut by two-thirds and that 99% of glass is made in China, and we look at all the energy required to get that glass here and then to recycle it, it just started to make more and more sense. And that's one of the things in business that you're constantly doing. You don't get everything exactly the way you want it. It's always a compromise.
And the price of shipping and the breakage.
Yeah, it's safer production. We don't have broken glass. If something happens, there's no risk of going into the food. So there are a lot of things to consider. Packaging, I never thought that I would become a packaging expert. But we have innovated from the beginning with packaging. We started out in a ceramic crock. I don't know if any of you remember that.
No.
$2 deposit. And, you know, it got us a lot of great attention, but it was, oh, my gosh, I cannot tell you how many problems we had with, you know, kraut juice bubbling over out of it, molding the moldy cork lids, and Whole Foods calling me and saying, "What's happening? These aren't 16 ounces," because the kraut juice had kind of come out, and now they were only 13 ounces. And I, 4 o'clock in the morning, driving from Whole Foods to Whole Foods in Northern California with my production manager changing out all the crocks. Those are some of the packaging stories I have that were kind of like the Whole Foods poster child for what can go wrong with packaging. So to finally be in a package that is sane has been just wonderful.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Grace, another audience member, has a question about what kind of interaction you've had with consumers to get feedback on products, focus groups, and what has guided the design of your products over time.
That's a good question. We've had a lot of interactions with consumers through demos and promotions that we do at Whole Foods. We did road shows at Costco. We reach out to a lot of consumers during those activities to learn more about what people like, who our customers are, consumers that is. We actually get a lot of feedback online as well about people loving the product, people wanting us to do different flavors. I think more recently there was somebody who really wanted us to do a white chocolate with coconut product. So we always keep track of those things. Our director of client relations is very good at cataloging all of that information and giving it back to the management at the company. We also use demo coordinators that actually catalog it through their own system as well, so we can read through the comments of consumers directly that way. And then the second part of that question was?
About the design.
What has guided the design of the product?
Yeah, so early on, Dennis has handled much of the design, and early on, both founders wanted a very clean, kind of organic-looking packaging. A lot of people commend us for the packaging. We've won an award or two on it as well. It's just plain, simple, approachable. People love the colors, and that's been the mindset behind the design.
And the way their bars are made are just, it's a very laborious process.
Yeah, they're all made by hand at this point.
I couldn't believe it.
Every single step.
Elizabeth, here's a great question. If someone is just trying to raise money, when and how is a good time to develop a business plan that might not be a six-month process, but something that's crisp enough to raise money, but where they can get the money quickly?
This is such a great question. How many of you had business plans the first time you had an outside investor?
I did.
I mean, yeah. If you ask this question to a room full of
radio listeners, two people raise their hands.
So I think, I mean, if you ask around, there's always this question, do I really need a business plan? That's question number one. And then, do I need a business plan to raise money? And from my perspective, I think the reason to do a business plan is to crunch the numbers to figure out what you're going to need to do for the business to make it worth you investing your time and life energy and life savings and mortgage the house a second time, etc. So you want to convince yourself first that it's worth doing what you're setting out to do. So that's why I think a business plan is a great idea. And from personal experience, I ran a business for 3 years before I wrote the business plan, at which point I realized it was not going to take me where I wanted to go, and I threw in the towel. So one example. And a lot of people also run a business for years without a business plan, and they raise money without it. I think what's more important than whether or not you need one to raise money is how good are you at articulating the value proposition of the business, the values that you based the business upon, and not only what's in it for the business if somebody invests, but what's in it for them and what's in it for the rest of the world.
I think a business plan prior to raising money is really important. It also makes you more legitimate. I can't tell you, even just with friends and family, handing them a business plan, they realize that this is no longer a hobby or a dream, that this is something I've worked at, and mine was like 100 pages of just...
Vetted.
Yes. Yeah. So I think it's really, really important.
Yeah, but what I would say too is, and here's where maybe we can get provocative, a lot of people want to raise money for the sake of raising money and continuing to do what they're doing. But you can do more damage to your life and to the business even and to your customers to raise money under inappropriate terms that will lead you down a path that is not where you wanted to go. So I would question this prioritization of raising money. I really think that the opportunity to articulate your values and what it is you're trying to do and how you define success is, that's the part of the business plan that I think is really important before you approach anybody, whether it be a business partner, an employee, a major buyer, a co-packer, or somebody who might be part of your financial relationships. Because if you haven't articulated those values for yourself, you're going to get dragged wherever the investor wants you to go once you've signed a piece of paper. And I also hope you've done the research to understand what those terms mean so that when you're signing on the dotted line, you know what you're giving away and when. I mean, you had mentioned that you got these great equity investors and you never had to pay them back, but they now own stock in your company. I imagine they're wanting to get paid back in some way at some time. So what is that going to look like?
Well, I'm pretty fortunate with my terms because, again, my contracts just were really set up in, I would say, my favor. And it's about your sales as well. I mean, you're always selling, whether you're selling your product or you're selling yourself or the idea. And it's just having them buy into the concept and them wanting you to succeed also just for you because you're working so hard. My contracts say that, like, I am the decision maker, and while I have a board of directors and we all vote, my vote counts more. So basically, we would all love to eventually have benefits of a sale, but that'll happen when I would say I'm ready.
You go, girl.
Yep. Awesome.
At this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Susie Wyshack, author of Good Food, Great Business, and I'm moderating a panel with Jill Litwin of Peace of Mind, Catherine Lucas of Farmhouse Culture, Grace Erickson of Ocho Candy, and Elizabeth Wu, author of Raising the Dough and Coach to Food Entrepreneurs. So, we have a few more questions from our audience. This is a good question, I think, for Catherine. As your business is growing, how are you finding team members to work with and trusted people maybe for operations or other aspects of the business, your lawyers, people who are supporting you through your growth?
Oh, that's a good question, because I'm at the stage now in the company where I'm putting together an executive team to run the company. And that's really scary if you've been running it and wearing all the hats. And so finding the right people is probably one of the more challenging things I think any entrepreneur will do. And finding, and if you're a perfectionist and a really, really great and can do the work of three people, all of a sudden you're not going to find that in everybody else, right? And so managing expectations and inspiring people and going from being in front of customers and talking to them about your product or investors, and now like selling your team on, you know, your product and you and your vision, that's where it becomes. And then this trust that has to develop in order for them to take it to the next level, because I can't grow the company anymore on my own. And in terms of attorneys and it's just been, it's a network, and you, as you get into the business, you just start asking your friends and the people that you meet at these events or wherever. Most of us work so much that we don't see each other except for shows and things like this. But we stay in touch, I find. And so just networking is the way we've been able to find some really great people to work with.
And Jill, I know early on you told me the frozen food is a brutal section to be in the market.
Yeah.
What media or marketing has been most effective for you to reach the moms and build your business as you've expanded?
I always say that if the freezer section is like New York City, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. I would say the number one marketing that we do, which is so important for your retailers and for you, is working with the retailer and marketing inside the store. And that means putting your products on sale, having it on an end cap, placing an ad in their weekly. It'll make them very happy with you by doing that, and you'll sell product. So that's the number one marketing that we do. We also, around new product launches, which happen every year, we hire a publicist, and she goes out and she gets us PR and mom-specific media outlets, and that's really important too. We do that more than, I would say, advertising, because it just has a better outcome for us. And then lastly, we do a lot of donations, whether it be for schools. Schools are raising money for something. We'll donate something for their raffle, and that gets our name out there. We do a lot of those throughout the year, actually, so that's helped.
And I'd love to hear from you, Grace, too. There's lots of candy out there. What's been most effective for Ocho to reach your target audience?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, with candy, you're at the whim of the market, really, and the retailers, they govern what you can and can't do, and for the most part, they want promotions. They want you to discount your product, and a lot of times that's when the consumers really see your product, is when you're, you know, at a 2-for-3 promotion or at some other type of discount. So at first, we weren't wild about having to be in this situation where you're constantly being asked to discount your product, but over time, you really begin to realize with product launches, you have to. It's how you get seen by consumers and also other retailers, and it's worked out really well for us. So we pride ourselves in taking very good care of people that carry our product, and we do lots of demos. We want to get on the ground floor as much as we can with our product and see our consumers face-to-face. And then we also do promotions at certain times of the year, so probably two or three times a year. Go ahead.
Well, one of the things that I was thinking about in terms of marketing and also fundraising for startup or newer companies, since several of you raised your hands to say that you weren't yet selling product, is that using online crowdfunding campaigns or some of the other community-based financing methods that are out there, it's a really fantastic move because not only are you raising money, you are marketing through this campaign, and you are bringing on board, you know, ambassadors that will then champion your product and your business over their lifetimes. So it's a great way to not only do marketing and not only do financing, but bring that community organizing muscle to help you in a variety of ways.
Exactly. We did a brief Kickstarter campaign for that very reason. It wasn't a time where we were necessarily looking for a lot of funding, but we wanted that marketing. We definitely have a couple of companies that work for us to promote us both online and directly with the retailers, brokers, and such. That helps too.
Here's a good million-dollar question someone asked. Are you all making a good living? Like, are you happy? Are you paying yourself salaries?
Why don't you go first?
No, you go.
Yes, I'm getting paid a salary. I mean, I see my salary right now is being more of an investment into the business, and that as an owner who has an exit strategy, the exit will be my salary later on. So I'm not really looking at the today, I'm looking at the future when it comes to money that I take home, if that makes sense.
I made $40,000 in 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I just kept putting my money back into the business, and I was in a situation where I didn't have a whole lot of living expenses, and so I was able to just keep using my income to fund the company. And but in the last couple of years, that's shifted, and I'm paying myself not a totally competitive salary, but I'm paying myself certainly a living salary, and it feels great.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, working for startups, you don't necessarily get 100% of market rate, but even though that's not the case, you get a wealth of experience from your exposure and ability to wear several different hats. So I would say that, yes, I'm very happy with my current position.
And looking at the state of the drought, I think about the drought a lot, and different issues of the food system, competition, are there any challenges you all would foresee, whoever wants to chime in, for someone starting up today who's creating sustainable food products using probably locally sourced produce? Or is there, what would you impart to someone developing products?
Something we didn't touch on when it came to ingredients was called something called contracting. And I'm going to go back to the relationship. I think it's sourcing from a place where you have a relationship and having them be your primary source and hope that they take care of you by knowing that in the beginning. And then eventually when you get large enough, you do something called a contract. And a contract is when you commit to purchasing so many pounds from this supplier, and they will give you a price, and that price will remain the same no matter what happens, what fluctuation happens in the market for them. And so it's a win-win, I would say, and again, it's all about the relationship that you're forming with them.
The drought is an issue, and understanding where, depending on what products you're making, you need to understand where all of those ingredients are coming from and how stable the sources are. It's a super important part of your business plan. And this year, Dick at Lakeside lost about a month worth of crops due to centipedes, of all things. And they came, they just come out during droughts. The larvae usually in the wet weather don't survive, but they had enough dry weather over a period of time where they ate, you know, half of his crop. So it was a big deal that I had a contract.
Oh,
But our cabbage still wasn't that pretty during that time. So, you know, our yields weren't as great. So understanding yields is a super important part of the food business, and knowing that they're going to fluctuate. We took a big hit this year in our cost of goods because our yields weren't quite as great.
And how about sourcing or other challenges that Ocho might be facing, or can you think of any maybe challenges your company is having that might be useful to know about?
We try to source locally as much as we can, but not all of our ingredients can be sourced locally, so there's some international there. With the international ones, there's always a risk that supply is going to be an issue. Even with domestic ones, we actually have egg white powder that we use, and more recently we had trouble accessing more volume because the manufacturer, there's like only one in the country, was having trouble increasing their own supply. So we also use contracts and contract out for futures there and try to work very closely with our suppliers to make sure that we maintain the supply of inventory that we need. But there's always risks and surprises for sure when you're sourcing raw materials, and even working in the ag business, that's an even heavier thing to handle.
And this is something that sophisticated and especially institutional investors are going to be paying a lot of attention to. It's part of your overall risk management strategy. But more and more, especially for food businesses, climate change and how you are envisioning that will affect your business and how you will mitigate any potential risks that climate change might introduce to your business is something that those savvy investors are going to want to see in your plan.
Exactly. And something like cocoa, even, there's always some dramatic problem happening, either a drought or some sort of pest invasion and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of risks.
And I love talking to nut producers especially, and I was speaking to a walnut producer who said they had a great crop, and almond growers that they had plenty almonds, but they were much smaller than normal. So it is interesting to be on the cusp of what's happening with those commodities. Yeah. Elizabeth, one thing I'm fascinated with is community-funded businesses. Like if someone is starting a cronut shop and maybe they're going to package it, what are some success stories you've heard about or trends with the community getting involved, sort of like Kickstarter, but on the local level?
Yeah, I think, and you can use Kickstarter at a local level. One of the biggest misperceptions, and I think it's because of the name, about crowdfunding is that you put out this campaign and they will come. And it's absolutely not true. I mean, I spoke with somebody who said they should call it peer funding, because it really is a way of mechanizing a fundraising process, or it's almost like advanced sales if you're using it to launch a new product. You're tapping into your existing community and your existing network. I mean, I advise people that they know where at least a quarter to a third of those pledges are going to come from before you even hit go on the online platform, because you want to show momentum, you want to show that people are involved, and then maybe random strangers who happen to be browsing the site will come find you, but this is really peer funding. Mm-hmm. So, which is, you know, community financing, there's many ways of doing it. You don't need to use the online systems. You could also sell gift certificates. So I know of several retail businesses that sold gift certificates to their store. Breweries are doing this. In Mill Valley, there's a brewery that sold gift certificates as part of their community fundraising campaign. But it's a really great way, particularly for businesses that have been in existence for a while and have products and therefore already have some adoring fans that want to be part of their next steps to either expand or launch a new line.
I'm a fan of a business in like Michigan called Cops and Donuts, where a police force took over a donut shop that was going to close. That's one of my favorite stories. Catherine, an audience member is interested to know if you foresaw the popularity of fermented products, and I'm also curious if you're doing any marketing or education to get people eating kraut in more ways or.
I think I had a good sense that the timing was right with this business. There were just a lot of things that just seemed like, wow, there's a lot of opportunity here, and I don't see that many players. I did not know that science would help us understand the microbiome. That has just been amazing. That's a game changer, understanding that 99, I think for every one human cell you have 10 resident microbes. And that's amazing. That's amazing to me. And so that's really shifted the focus. Everybody's top 10, must-have nutritional food is something fermented. And I think that because 70% of Americans eat sauerkraut, I think they're all on the East Coast. now they're on the West Coast. This is a traditional condiment that we've been using from the beginning in this country, and this is a condiment that if you taste the real deal, you'll love it. And so I thought, gosh, this all seems like it could come together and be something wildly popular. What was the second part of that question?
Well, I'm curious if you put out recipes or if you're somehow getting into schools or getting kids into it at an early age.
Not yet. That's a good idea.
We need to work.
Can you freeze sauerkraut? You can't freeze sauerkraut. The bacteria survive, but it gets mushy. And, getting people to figure out how to eat kraut outside of the hot dog or sausage has been really fun. So we encourage fans all the time through Instagram and Facebook. People just come up with the greatest recipes, and so they've become our best sales force, our best marketing team. But it's interesting because who knew, that you could put ginger beet sauerkraut in your salad, That's 5 years ago, nobody was thinking about that.
True. Well, Jill, for one of our last questions, for people getting started, support is so important. Can you talk a little about how La Cocina helped you and how you feel an incubator was instrumental to your success?
So for me, I didn't have a lot of financing to start. So it's either financing or time. That's what I've learned in business, which meant it was going to take me time to get further along in the business. And La Cocina Community Kitchen is a nonprofit organization in San Francisco, and it's an incubator kitchen. And I would say it helped me tremendously. At the time, I was their first program participant, so they didn't really have the program established yet, and they sort of used me as a guinea pig for what I needed. And what I mean by that is, let's say I wanted to trademark like a name, or I was looking to volumize my recipes, I would go to them, and then they would reach out into the community, and they would hire mentors to come in and to work with me free of cost. And that was just really great and important. And being around other like-minded businesses, starting out as a collective, I think was really powerful. So we could share notes, talk about different buyers, what do I need to go on my first sales pitch, things like that. I don't think it's necessary that you launch at a commercial kitchen or an incubator program at all. I think that I think finding a mentor that can help you or being part of a mentorship program is like critical if you plan on kind of launching it yourself, bootstrapping, grassroots type of growth, which is what I did. And that was just really helpful.
Thank you. And our last audience question. Grace, what are a couple of tips you can offer for the customer discovery process? You've talked a little about how you get feedback and sampling. Is there any other specific way that you've figured out how or what customers really want in the packaging, size of the bars maybe, the different flavors?
It's a discovery process for sure. I mean, early on, depending on what stage you're in, you kind of have to hit the market and see who's most interested in your product to really understand who your core consumer is. Early on, everybody who has a product has sometimes has a very clear idea of who is going to be liking that product or attracted to it, but that's not necessarily the case when you hit the market as well. A lot of times we've learned a lot about who likes our product basically from people who've come up, as I've mentioned before, to demos and such, also feedback. But I think it's really instrumental to try and look for, instead of the typical demographics, commonalities that a lot of marketers rely on, something with candy and food. A lot of times you're not looking necessarily at, you know, what the gender is of a person or what the age or what the income level is. It's more about orientation and how they perceive themselves and life in general. Emotions are very big in food, and a lot of the market research that I did when I was at American Licorice, I learned a lot about how consumers view candy specifically. And one thing that was interesting is you would have the people who didn't eat candy at all, so they were out of the picture. Then you had the people who only ate chocolate. And then you had people who ate some candy, but they were really conflicted about it because of the fat. So they would eat it, and there's this whole association of guilt that goes along with it. And so there's that consumer. And then there's the consumer who eats candy but thinks of it as just a treat and also eats fruit as, say, a treat as well. So you have this kind of nutritious, more health-conscious consumer. And then lastly, you have a consumer who eats anything. It's like candy is just like, I love candy. I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's bad for me. I'm not guilty about it. So that, I think, thinking about food, not just candy, in that general term and approach is a good one. It's not just about traditional demographics. It's about how people think of food and of themselves and how that plays a part in that role and that emotion.
I always say to change the food system, it does need to start when kids are really young, because that comfort food is just stuck in your mind.
Yeah, it's what you grew up with. A lot of candy specifically has to do with that nostalgia and the emotion that you had when you were a kid, what you used to eat then, and how that is with you now, if it's still around, or things that are similar to that will draw people back and they'll love it. We get a lot of that at Ocho because we make organic versions of traditional candy bars. So people will tell us that it reminds them of a different bar out there on the market. One of my favorite feedback that we got early on was if somebody who's much, much older who said that our bars reminded her of the way candy bars used to taste when they first came out, when they were first made by the big guys now. So it's interesting to see how that's changed over the decades as well.
So it's like people going to the farmer's market saying, this is what tomatoes used to taste like.
And I wanted to add that tapping into emotion is like, I mean, it goes well past just like the taste. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was trying to come up with what I wanted the Peace of Mind logo to look like, and I was working with a designer, and she said, go into the market or anywhere and collect things that you like and tell me why. And I remember my favorite logo that I collected, which it's so hard to think that this is what it was Country Time Lemonade, because I looked at the logo and it was like the colors, it was like lemony yellow, it was woodeny wood, and I felt like, and it was hot, it was like, it felt like it was sweating, and I was sitting on a porch in like the South somewhere, and it totally got me. And I said, that's what I want. I want it to evoke this feeling of like sweetness and health and all these things, an emotion like that Country Time Lemonade did for me. So
that's a beautiful. Well, we are out of time, and I can't thank you all so much for being part of this panel. Jill Litwin of Peace of Mind, Catherine Lucas of Farmhouse Culture, Grace Erickson of Ocho Candy, and Elizabeth Wu, author of Raising Dough. I'm Susie Wyshak, and I would like to thank our audiences here on the radio and online. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.